From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, a new report from the United Nations accuses the Islamic State of committing staggering human rights abuses.
Executions, sexual violence against women and children, a whole list of terrible crimes apparently carried out by the Islamic State.
Also today, Hong Kong police are warning thousands of pro-democracy demonstrators not to attempt to occupy any government buildings. And as many as 100 people may have come into some form of contact with the first person ever diagnosed with Ebola on American soil.
There could be additional cases who were already exposed. If that occurs, systems are in place so that they will not further spread Ebola.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Despite increased pressure from pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong, the chief executive says he will not resign his post. However, Chief Executive C.Y. Leung did say his government is open to holding talks with demonstrators who have surrounded government buildings and occupied public streets to protest China's vetting of candidates in elections. But Mr. Leung says the protesters must back away from government property or face consequences. Health officials in the U.S. state of Texas say they are checking more than 100 people for signs of Ebola after they had contact with a man who has the disease. Thomas Eric Duncan was most likely exposed to Ebola while helping neighbors in Liberia, four of whom have since died. U.S. correspondent Priscilla Huff reports.
Four of Thomas Eric Duncan's family members have been ordered to remain at home until October 19th or face possible criminal charges. They are just some of the 100 or so Americans who have come into contact with a man now under care at Texas Presbyterian Hospital for Ebola. While health officials have said the passengers from the same flights as Mr. Duncan are at no risk of contracting Ebola because he was not showing any symptoms at the time, United Airlines has released his itinerary from Brussels through Washington to Houston, while other sources have revealed his airline flights from Monrovia to Brussels. U.S. officials continue to remind Americans that to contract Ebola, a person must come into contact with the bodily fluids of an infected patient. With the news another person is in isolation in Hawaii for a suspected case, many Americans are not reassured that the Ebola epidemic can be controlled.
The Parliament of Turkey has voted to allow its military to fight Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria. A three-quarters majority approved the resolution, which also allows foreign troops to use Turkish territory as a base for their campaign against ISIS. Meanwhile, the United Nations has accused the Islamic State of committing staggering human rights abuses, which could constitute war crimes. The head of the UN's mission in Iraq has described the new report as terrifying. Nick Harper reports from UN headquarters in New York.
Based on 500 interviews, the report details attacks against civilians, abductions, rapes, and executions. It documents what it calls an array of violations and abuses that are staggering, systematic, and widespread. The head of the mission in Iraq, Nikolai Mladenov, is now urging Iraq's leaders to unite to overcome IS and restore peace to the third of the country controlled by the insurgents. The report comes a day after the UN's mission announced at least 9,000 civilians had been killed so far this year, more than half of them in the last 3 months since the surge of IS.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. German internet company Rocket Internet fell 13% in its first day of trading. The disappointing performance cooled off excitement about a European tech boom. Ira Spitzer has more from Berlin.
Rocket Internet debuted on the Frankfurt Stock Exchange as the most anticipated German IPO of the year, before plunging almost 14% in the first few minutes of trading. Despite the stumble, Rocket still raised 1.6 billion euros, a figure that would have been considered a huge success just a few months ago. Rocket is a venture capital firm and startup incubator, which is known for copying proven online business models and rapidly expanding them into underserved markets. None of the companies in Rocket's portfolio has turned a profit yet, but the firm's new investors are hoping that big returns are on the horizon.
And Facebook has apologized for a policy that requires users to state their real names on their profiles after an outcry from the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transsexual community. Gay rights activists say the real name policy can lead to harassment. Here's Rebecca Bowering from San Francisco.
In an attempt to crack down on impersonation and bullying, Facebook has until now required users to identify themselves using the same name as they have on a government-issued ID card. The LGBT community has long objected, saying the policy is unfair to transgender people, drag queens, political dissidents, and domestic violence survivors. Tensions rose recently after one Facebook user reported several hundred accounts as fake, without noticing the pattern of one individual targeting the LGBT community in particular. The social network then warned account owners they must change over to real names. Following pressure from activists and politicians, Facebook now says the spirit of its policy is that everyone should be able to use the authentic name they use in real life. It's working on a way to verify the identities of those who prefer to use pseudonyms.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. A new report from the United Nations has accused the Islamic State of committing staggering human rights abuses. This comes as Turkey announced it's joining the fight against ISIS. The head of the UN's mission in Iraq has described the report as terrifying. And the list is so extensive, the UN is now calling for IS to be referred to the International Criminal Court. FSN's Nick Harper is at the United Nations in New York, and I began by asking him what this report revealed.
Yes, a truly shocking report, which the United Nations say shows the extent of the Islamic State's abuses over the last few months. Some of the terms that they use to describe this report are in themselves astounding. They say that this documents an array of violations and abuses, violations that are staggering, and they say the abuses are systematic and widespread. Overall, it's quite a short report, just 29 pages long, but it details things like rapes, executions, sexual violence against women and children, forced recruitment of children into militia, a whole list of terrible crimes apparently carried out by the Islamic State. The head of the mission in Iraq, Nikolai Mladenov, is calling this report terrifying, and he's urging all of Iraq's leaders to unite. But of course, Iraq still has a big political divide. Trying to get everyone together to fight against IS is proving particularly difficult.
And now there are calls to refer the Islamic State to the International Criminal Court. Is that possible?
Well, yes, the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayed Raad al-Hussein, has looked at this report, and he's saying that many of the acts amount to war crimes or crimes against humanity, and as such, he wants to refer the Islamic State to the International Criminal Court. Here's the spokesperson for the UN Human Rights Office, Rupert Colville.
A more immediate, urgent measure to request the court directly to take on the situation as it is now. It sets in process court procedures, so some of the people who are committing these atrocious abuses on such a huge scale one day face justice. Obviously, it'll take time, but you need to get that process underway if possible.
Of course, an ICC referral is not automatic. It's something that the UN Security Council would have to debate and unanimously decide upon. But it does seem that there's momentum and political will at the moment amongst the Security Council to make something like this happen. Just last week, during the UN General Assembly, the Security Council met and they unanimously approved a resolution against foreign fighters, trying to clamp down on countries to make them accountable for having foreign fighters, therefore making it illegal to have people within their country who were funding terrorism, or to allow anyone that they thought were going to be involved in terrorist acts from entering or exiting their countries.
And Nick, there have been new figures from the UN showing the impact on civilians.
As well as this list of terrible abuses, there are also staggering statistics attached to them. The UN's mission in Iraq each month tots up the number of people who've been killed, and they say that during the last month, in September, more than 1,100 people were killed. Of those, 850 were civilians, and almost 2,000 people were injured. And when you collect together all of the data from 2014, The UN is saying that so far this year, 9,000 civilians have been killed in Iraq, and they say that more than half of that number have been killed during just the last 3 months alone, since IS took over vast swathes of the country.
Nick Harper at the UN headquarters. Now, with the UK Air Force now supporting US and Arab airstrikes against IS targets in Iraq and Syria, Britain's Deputy Prime Minister was asked on LBC Radio that if tackling domestic extremism was being neglected in favour of a foreign war.
Plea of help went out from a government in a Muslim country in Iraq and said, we need help to deal with these lunatics. They're doing a lot of the fighting on the ground, or all the fighting on the ground, the Iraqi army and the Peshmerga in the north, the Kurdish north of Iraq. But they said to the international community, help us from the skies. We need your help. And that is what we're responding to. And I think, in a sense, there's lots of complexity to this, but that was a rather simple choice. Do you respond to a plea for help or not? The second thing is, because, Kim, unfortunately, we know that what goes on over there has an effect over here as well. They're not two separate worlds, as you suggest, Kim. It's not just a question of sort of looking after our own, so to speak, and hoping that the problem, you know, further afield will disappear. We know that there are lots and lots of, unfortunately, impressionable youngsters whose minds have been warped by this vile ideology, by these barbarians in ISIL, who go to Syria and Iraq. And we've even seen, have you seen in the papers over the last couple of days, this report of this 15-year-old girl,
who they fear...
Exactly, who Somerset Navy and police fear may have gone to Syria or Iraq. And, of course, I mean, never mind what happens to them there, the great sort of fear, and I was talking to the Metropolitan Commissioner, Bernard Hogan Howe, about this last week, the fear is, of course, if they come back, they will then seek to do us harm here, Kim. So, you know, look, in this world, this is a problem like so many other problems in this world. We're all connected. This, you know, we can't cut ourselves off from what's going on, even though it might seem quite remote and far away.
But to those who say that by allying ourselves with America, which is seen as the great foe, potentially we put more British citizens at risk, and we perhaps, in a way, enforce these jihadist ambitions or desires to come back and wreak havoc here in Britain, what would you say?
Well, I'd say to that is that before we even had the debate in the House of Commons, they were chopping off the heads of innocent Brits. I mean, what more evidence do you need that it wasn't our decision to participate? And by the way, participate in a kind of jigsaw of military activity, which is much wider than our participation. So we're providing some airstrikes in Iraq. But as you know, that there are a number of Arab states, very important, this Sunni Arab states, in addition.
Is it right that Turkey is now signing up?
No, I think today the vote is about, in the Turkish parliament, I need to check, I think the vote today is about whether Turkey will accept military ground activity from foreign soldiers on their soil.
How might that be, Turkey in some way joins?
I think Turkey is absolutely crucial because of their location, huge border with the area of conflict with Syria, because of the huge numbers of people coming into Turkey fleeing ISIL, and because of the possibility, if you like, of people going into Turkey to do damage to Turkey, or indeed further afield in the West, or indeed people using Turkey as a transit. This girl we were talking about earlier, I think I'm right in saying that Somerset Navy and police saw that she'd gone with a friend
from Lambeth
to Istanbul.
Istanbul. Yeah,
so it is the frontline state. It is the great ally, if you like, for us in the region. And remember, most importantly, perhaps of all, it is a member of NATO. And so it is of disproportionate importance, Turkey. And our relationship with Turkey, which is very strong and very close, I think is of huge significance right now.
UK Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg on LBC Radio. This is FSN Reports. As many as 100 people may have had some form of contact with the first person ever diagnosed with Ebola on American soil. Health officials in Texas say they're working around the clock to interview all those involved, but stress that not everyone had close contact with the patient, Thomas Duncan.
We remain confident that we can contain any spread of Ebola within the United States. He didn't have a fever when he was in transit, and all of our subsequent interviews confirm that he began having symptoms 5 days after he arrived in this country.
The Center for Disease Control Director, Dr. Tom Frieden, talking earlier. 4 close family members of the patient have been ordered to stay home and avoid having visitors for several weeks. For more of an overview on the situation, we spoke to Tara Smith, Associate Professor at Kent State University and expert in infectious diseases.
I don't know. From what I've read about his clinical outlook right now, it's not very good. That he initially reported to healthcare and they sent him home, probably misdiagnosed him, it appears. And then he came back 2 days later, much sicker. So, again, without knowing the details of his illness, it's hard to say. Also, some of the experimental treatments that some of the other people had received are not available right now, like ZMAP. So whether he will get other experimental treatments, such as perhaps donor plasma, I'm not sure and have not seen anything confirmed one way or the other on that.
So experimental treatments aside, I mean, what will the basic medical care be for this person?
Mm-hmm. Really, the basic thing to do is to keep them hydrated. You can lose a lot of fluid from this and rapidly go into organ failure. So that's, you know, really probably what they're going to be doing for him as a primary care is just making sure that he's hydrated and comfortable.
Hydrated and comfortable. And how long could this period last where they will have him under observation and before they may know which course the disease will take either way? Mm-hmm. Or is it not? Are we not able to actually know that?
Yeah, I don't know. Again, it kind of depends on where he is really in his illness and how fast he's going, you know, downhill or not. People can be sick for, you know, just a few days to, you know, up to 7 to 10 days before it's really kind of determined whether they're going to get better or not.
Are you able just to remind us why a case of Ebola in the United States isn't a reason to hit the panic button? I mean, this isn't a virus that is easily transferred, right?
Right, right. People are contagious when they're symptomatic, so when they're showing symptoms of the disease. And they're only contagious to those who are in very close contact with them. So perhaps if this patient had family members that were caring for him or a spouse or something like that, that would be very closely exposed to him and body fluids that he might be producing. They would be at risk for infection. Potentially some of the healthcare workers he may have been in contact with during his initial visits may be at risk for infection, although that's probably low. The average person on the street who, you know, may have passed him on the grocery store or something like that is not at risk for infection. This is not like influenza or measles, does not travel through the air.
We have had some alarming predictions of just how many people could be infected. I think at one point they were talking, one health authority talked about perhaps 1 million cases by the end of January 2015. Mm-hmm. Do you see this virus following that sort of devastating rate of infection?
Yeah, it's so hard to tell because, you know, there, so many variables can flip that one way or another. Obviously, the United States is now sending additional money and troops over to assist with the control efforts. International partners are hopefully jumping on board, or soon will be, to also lend additional money and personnel. Mm-hmm. So if there's a good influx of international support, hopefully it won't get to that level. But if things progress the way they are now, with cases increasing every week at a more rapid rate, then we certainly could see something up to that level. Hopefully it won't be, but that definitely appears to be one of the worst case scenarios that they've put forth.
Tara Smith, Associate Professor at Kent State University and an expert in infectious diseases. Now to Hong Kong, where police are warning thousands of pro-democracy demonstrators not to attempt to occupy any government buildings. Authorities vowed they will respond firmly if protesters try any such move. Protest leaders are demanding that Hong Kong's top official resign by the end of the day and that China allow free and fair elections. Beijing calls the pro-democracy protests illegal and has warned other nations not to meddle in China's affairs. Chris Hughes is a professor of Chinese politics and he spoke to LBC Radio earlier.
Well, it is a bit like watching two cars on a collision course at the moment, and they don't seem to be slowing down. They seem to be speeding up on both sides. As you said, the student movement, it's not just a student movement now, it's become more or less the whole city in Hong Kong, have hardened their demands. They set a deadline for the chief executive to step down and for China to start talking about proper democracy in 2017. That deadline's passed. They want to occupy government buildings now, and at the same time, the authorities in Hong Kong are putting more and more police outside those buildings. So you can see that there's a red line here, which if the protesters cross that red line, there could well be more violence. And we saw violence last weekend with the tear gas used by the police, and that just escalated the tension. And if that happens again, Beijing is already making sounds that it's not going to accept this situation continuing, and that if the law, as they see it, the law is broken, then there will be serious consequences.
Yes, indeed. So there's just a quote, actually, I want to put to you from a paper today. China's Communist Party has warned of unimaginable consequences if the demonstrations continue. The threat apparently made in the People's Daily. That is a threat, isn't it?
That's right. And also the Chinese foreign minister who's in Washington at the moment also said something similar, that if the law is broken, then there will be consequences. So the rhetoric from Beijing is beginning to harden now. So, you know, you can see all around on all sides that there's a kind of acceleration of this collision. That really does worry me. So I've been worried all along about what Beijing is going to do. I cannot see them accepting this situation for much longer. And, you know, it's still 3 years up until the next election in Hong Kong in 2017. So even if by some lucky chance the situation did, the tension was reduced now, there's still just nearly 3 years to get through where this kind of thing is just going to happen again and again. So it's really a very unstable situation for the next 3 years in Hong Kong. And I think in the immediate future, I'm very concerned about the safety of those demonstrators.
Chris Hughes, Professor of Chinese Politics, speaking on LBC Radio. For more perspective on how the United States has responded to these protests so far, FSN's Lorna Shaddock spoke to Dr. Eli Ratner, a senior fellow and deputy director of the Asia Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security.
Sure. Well, I think the U.S. response to the protests in Hong Kong has been careful insofar as it's very clear that Beijing is looking to build these protests as in part being motivated by foreign actors and foreign pressure, and often blames the United States for their domestic and international troubles. So I think even though U.S. officials are expressing concern, calling upon the Hong Kong police and Beijing to be peaceful in their response, I think the goal, part of the goal of the United States is not to be seen as a protagonist or a leading figure in these protests.
And the problem with that, perhaps, is that certainly given what the protesters outside the Chinese embassy have been saying, is that the US did act quite forcefully in Ukraine for those pro-democracy protests. Should it not be doing similarly here, and does it seem a little lopsided in terms of a response?
Well, given that Hong Kong is not an independent country, I think there are obvious differences. And the United States has always been, again, careful in how it's managed political movements, even in Taiwan, which has more independence than Hong Kong, but also as it relates to Hong Kong and other areas, autonomous regions of China, in which there are pro-independence elements that are dissatisfied with Beijing's rule. So I think a similar event outside of the People's Republic of China would be much different than what we're seeing in Hong Kong in terms of the American response.
And of course, President Obama is heading to China in November. How much of a likelihood is there that he will bring up these protests?
Well, I think it depends on what's happening on the ground at the time. National Security Advisor Susan Rice did raise these issues when she visited for the first time recently. If the protests are ongoing or if there's a violent response from Beijing or from the Hong Kong police, I think it will be raised. But the United States and China have a lot of issues to discuss together that are incredibly important related to Syria and Iran and Russia and the South China Sea and the East China Sea, not to mention the bilateral issues. So this will be one of many issues that President Obama is likely to raise.
I was going to say, what is the feeling ahead of that meeting on the state of U.S.-China relations and how successful a meeting that might be?
I think the current consensus on both sides is that the relationship is not in a great place right now. I think both sides are looking for ways to demonstrate positive aspects of the relationship, whether it's in the area of climate change or on military-to-military relations or even bilateral economic issues. But I don't think there are great hopes for this meeting to demonstrate a very positive U.S.-China relationship. I think both sides are actually resigned to that outcome at this point.
And do you think, going back to the protests again, is there an element of concern not only at stake but also at the Pentagon that there could be a potentially violent response to these protests if they continue and if they escalate?
I think there is. Certainly there are concerns that it could escalate on either side. I think after the first night of pepper spray and tear gas, the Hong Kong police seem to have tamped down their use of force. And Beijing, according to reports, seems to content now to try to wait out the protesters. I think the question is, if there's a precipitating event on either side, either the protesters doing something unexpected or, say, a rogue policeman doing something that's caught on film or injuring a protester, that could escalate events in unforeseen ways. And we may see that, in fact, in the next 24 hours, given that the protesters have set deadlines and have made demands, for instance, for the resignation of the chief executive of Hong Kong, and have said if that doesn't occur, they may actually occupy government buildings in Hong Kong. So there may be new standoffs that precipitate action. But I wouldn't expect to see violence from Beijing that's not precipitated, at least by agitation from the protesters.
And if the action does ramp up in the next 24 hours, what do you think we can expect in terms of a response from state and from the White House?
I think there would be strong diplomatic concern expressed in the event of real violence by, again, the Hong Kong police or Beijing. But short of that, it's not clear exactly how the United States or the international community would intervene in the short term beyond diplomatic pressure, and if that doesn't work, at some point, economic pressure.
And I know that Robert Menendez has sent a letter to the Hong Kong chief executive expressing his concern and urging restraint and universal suffrage. Is that unhelpful for the State Department?
Well, actually, in U.S.-China relations, Congress can play a special role of sending strong messages that would be difficult sometimes for the administration or the president to send. So, in fact, on issues related to human rights or territorial disputes or Taiwan, it's not uncommon, actually, that Congress can send firmer and stronger messages in a way that actually are helpful, in a way that isn't always easy for the president to do himself. So I think in this instance, that was a smart move, and I think we'll likely see more of that as this goes forward.
And so when it comes to that meeting in November, do you think we're going to see any concrete announcements as a result of that at the end of the summit between Obama and Xi?
I think they're hoping for that. My understanding is that they're close to agreements on military-to-military announcements, which could be actually quite significant in terms of warnings about exercises or otherwise. It's somewhat ironic now that military-to-military relations appear to be, in some ways, the best part of the U.S.-China relationship. It's an important one. Again, there may be agreements on climate or investment, but I don't think there are going to be a lot of important deliverables out of this meeting.
Dr. Eli Ratner, Senior Fellow and Deputy Director of the Asia Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to contact us, email us reports@featurestory.com. And of course, you can follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone, with Feature Story News everywhere. Have a great evening. Goodbye.